The Old Testament reading is from Genesis chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So, after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" She said, "I am fleeing from my mistress, Sarai." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen." So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God of seeing," for she said, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. The New Testament reading is from Revelation chapter 12. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Let us pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So when I was a child, I spent many an hour in my Southern Baptist Sunday school classroom, soaking in stories about heroes. There were the three brave young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who stood up to that mean old King Nebuchadnezzar, even if it meant they were going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And there was Noah, facing down a whole world of wicked people, hammering and sawing away on his ark when, unlike today, there wasn't a cloud yet in the sky. And there was David, the runt of Jesse's litter, taking down that Philistine giant with nothing but a stone and a sling. I was a boy in search of heroes, and I found them within the pages of the Old Testament. When I was a young man in my 20s, I spent many an hour in seminary and university classrooms, and I was soaking in these same stories, but with a little different perspective. You see, they captivated my academic mind. And that's why I like the Bible. There were Hebrew nouns and verbs to analyze. There were parallel flood stories from Mesopotamian myths to compare to Noah and his ark. There were histories to read of who the Philistines and Babylonians and the Persians were. I was an academic and looking for research, and I found it within the pages of the Old Testament. And then my mid-30s rolled around, and my early 40s and now late 40s. The boy who loved the stories of heroes in the Old Testament and the young academic who loved the intellectual treasure trove of the Hebrew Bible gave way to a very different perspective. You see, I began to realize that the biblical heroes of my childhood weren't quite so heroic. Giant killing David grew up to be what today we might call a sexual predator who abused his power in order to sleep with his friend's wife and then got her pregnant and then her husband killed on the battlefield and then, acting like a big-hearted king, married this poor war widow. Some hero. Noah, the man that stood up to the world, couldn't even stand up anymore because he drank so much and he passed out drunk and naked inside his tent. Not exactly a super saint. All my heroes turned out to be scoundrels and villains and drunks and cheaters. And I also realized that my academic interest in the Old Testament was simultaneously starving my soul. You see, it's kind of like a guy who was looking at a piece of rich and delicious chocolate cake. But instead of eating it and enjoying the sweetness, I was analyzing the recipe and comparing it to other desserts and counting the calories. When I read the Bible now, I don't do so in search of spiritual heroes. Nor do I look for facts with which to kind of stroke my intellectual ego. Instead, on its pages, I read narratives of people whose stories seem eerily familiar to all of us. I mean, we don't get three chapters into the Bible before there's already a conflict between a husband and a wife, and bitterness and kind of backstabbing, and that might seem familiar to you. We don't get four chapters in before there's already friction between two brothers, and jealousy, and outrage, and even bloodshed. We get a few more chapters in, nine chapters in, and we meet our first drunk. We get 12 chapters into the Bible, and that great hero of faith named Abraham basically is willing to let his wife go to Pharaoh's harem so that he himself can get rich off the deal. And if you were here yesterday, you heard all about Jacob. And he's like worthy of his own reality TV show. Now, you got everything from polygamy to child favoritism to backstabbing to incest to a whole lot of other that's kind of mature audience only material. But you know what else we encounter in the Old Testament? Besides these sordid stories of people who seem hell-bent on jacking up their own lives and the lives of others, we encounter a really strange God. See, rather than like wadding up these losers and tossing them into the cosmic garbage, this God tightens up the laces of his Nikes and he sprints after these people. When they end up face first in the mud, he lifts them up and cleans them up and puts them back on the path. He also has a marked tendency to appear when somebody's chips are down. I mean, when they're at the very end of their rope. When it feels like they've lost all hope and they're either literally or figuratively stuck in this lifeless wilderness where there's nowhere to go but deeper into despair. Just ask the young lady that we heard about in the Old Testament reading this morning. Just ask Hagar. Hagar was Sarah's maidservant. Since she was Egyptian, she was probably picked up by them during their infamous foray into Egypt when Sarah ended up in Pharaoh's pocket and Pharaoh's pockets ended up with the country's wealth. Not exactly the prettiest story about this patriarch and matriarch of Israel. But now they're back in the Holy Land. Abraham is 85 years old and Sarah is 75 years old. And when they moved to this place years ago, God had promised them a son. Now, if it's pretty hard to believe that a couple that are both collecting Social Security checks can get pregnant. It's even harder to believe now that 10 more years have passed and there's still no nativity of this promised son. Since it seemed like God wasn't doing his job, like he was kind of lollygagging around, Abraham and Sarah decided to take matters into their own hands and into another woman's bed, into Hagar's bed. You see, it was a relatively common custom back in those days when if a wife couldn't get pregnant, that she could give her maidservant to her husband and he would have sex with her, and if she conceived, and that baby that was born would be declared to be the child of the mistress of the family. So the maidservant would sort of serve as a surrogate mother. And if any of you have read or watched the TV show or the novel, The Handmaiden, you kind of have an idea as to how well this was going to work out. Well, the plan did work. And you could say that it worked too well. Abraham did indeed get Hagar pregnant. But it wasn't just a baby that was conceived. Conceived also was jealousy and haughtiness and strife. Hagar, when she got pregnant, also kind of got all uppity, thinking that she was better than Sarah. And Sarah, in turn, because she felt despised, got mad, and she started abusing the pregnant woman, and then she lashed out at her husband like it was all his fault, and then she even brought God into the picture, and she's like, well, God needs to judge between me and you. And then Abraham just like kind of tossing up in his hands. He's like, well, she's your maidservant, so do with her whatever you want to. It's quite a fiasco. That's kind of what happens when we decide that we kind of know better than God how to get things done, right? And how fast they should happen. And we decide just how and when the Lord should act. Well, in the end, what happens? Well, Abraham acts the coward, Sarah acts the abuser, and Hagar decides that she's going to act as well. She's going to get out of Dodge. She's going to hightail it. So now she's in exile with a child in utero. And where do we find her? We find her in a place that if I were a betting man, I bet every single one of us has been at one time or another. And for some of you, it's your current address. It's a place that's known by many names. God-forsakenness, depression, despair, loneliness, that dark night of the soul. It's a place where darkness reigns even when the sun is shining. It's a place where you can have people all around you and you always feel alone. Where yesterday haunts you and tomorrow scares you and today it feels like you're stuck in a grave with handfuls of dirt being thrown on you from a heaven that just doesn't seem to care. But as it turns out, Hagar discovered, as we ourselves discover, that in that place where we feel farthest from God is when God happens to be nearest to us. When this pregnant and abused and forsaken refugee was all alone in the wilderness, then and only then did the Lord pay her a visit. He came to her, as he often did in the Old Testament, in the form of a messenger, usually translated as the angel of the Lord. But this is no created angel like Michael or Gabriel or one of the other angels. This is like the messenger of God, the word bearer of God, the one who brings the word from the Father. He's the word himself. He is the Son. So this messenger, this Son of God, he visits Hagar. Just think about how incredible that is. He who would one day be inside pregnant Mary comes to be beside pregnant Hagar. And he makes her a promise. He sends her back to her maidservant. But he doesn't send her back empty-handed. He sends her back with a promise that she's going to have a son. And she's going to have many descendants. But more importantly, he sends her back with the promise that he has seen her. And isn't it nice just to be seen, to be noticed, to be known, especially by God? He's seen her. He's seen her affliction. He's seen her pain. And he's going to see her through it all. And then this amazing thing happens. When this divine messenger appears, Hagar gives him a name. In Hebrew, she calls him El Roy, which means the God who sees. It's amazing to me because Hagar is the one and only person in the whole Old Testament who gives God a name. The Lord so arranges this story that it's not an insider, but an outsider who does this. It's not some powerful king like David or Solomon. It's not some great prophet or lawgiver like Isaiah or Moses. It's this maidservant, this lonely and forsaken woman who's given this unique privilege. Centuries later, another young pregnant mother would name him Jesus. But here, this young pregnant mother names him Elroy. He's the God who sees. The God who doesn't close his eyes to our affliction. Who has 20/20 vision for those who feel like they're suffocated by the darkness. You might say that Hagar is the patron saint of all those who feel as if God doesn't see. As if he's blind to our sufferings. Hagar is living proof that he is not. He is El Roy. He is the God who sees. He saw Hagar. He sees you. He sees you even when it feels like you're buried so deep in grief, and heartache, or addiction, or loneliness, or despair, that it feels like even divine eyes can't penetrate that darkness. His eyes can, and his eyes do. Jesus is El Roy. He's the God who sees. Out of the depths we cry to him, and he doesn't answer from heaven. He answers from those same depths that we're in. And he says, I'm here. I am with you. You can't see me, but reach out your hand and touch my hand and feel that scar from the nails. Run your fingers over the skin. Now reach up to my side and touch me here and you feel that scar. Now reach up. Touch my face and feel the tears that flow because I weep with you and I weep for you. I love you. These scars are for your healing. These tears will moisten your withered hope because I'm Jesus, your brother and your Lord. I'm El Roy, the God who sees. The body of Jesus bears evidence that he sees. Every scar, from his hands to his side to his feet, give witness that he came and he saw our great need. He came down from heaven to do what needed to be done to save us. He saw us all the way to the cross, all the way to his own suffering, all the way to his own forsakenness, even into the darkness of death. And he went in wide eyes open because he is that strange God of the Old Testament who pursues us wherever it takes him. Even into the grave and out again. El Roy, the God who sees, is precisely the God who loves. No sin is so great that his mercy is not greater. There's no shame that's so deep that his love is not deeper. There's no death that you feel that his life is not stronger. He will see you through, even better, he will bear you up in his arms and carry you through, rejoicing with every step that he takes because he holds in his arms that which is more precious to him than anything in the world. He holds you, the apple of his eye, his child, the one who's more important to him than even life itself. All thanks and praise be to him.